Hi, friends, and welcome to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today, we're joined by author Jason Berry. He is an author of 10 books, including his most recent, City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. He also has a lengthy and storied career as an investigative journalist. He was the journalist who broke the clergy sex abuse case back in the early 90s, published eventually two books on that and another book on the Vatican Bank. He worked as an investigative journalist with, as I said, ABC. He is a resident of New Orleans. He's married and he has two children, one passed. He is actually wrapping up a movie right now, Parading, City of a Million Dreams, and the subtitle is Parading for the Dead in New Orleans. So certainly a busy person immersed in the life of New Orleans. And we're here today to talk about the issues surrounding the Confederate monuments and where we are. So welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you, Pearson. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you know, last time we were together, we talked about all your books and we got into, you know, New Orleans history generally. And I learned all kinds of things that I really had absolutely no idea of. And again, confirmed that New Orleans is an extraordinarily interesting place. This time it's different. We're going to talk about a column you wrote recently for the Advocate, Advocate New Orleans, I think, on the controversy about changing out street names, changing monuments in New Orleans, and all that kind of stuff. So tell me, what led you to write your column for the Advocate? Did it come out in the Advocate, or was that the Times-Picayune?
Well,
I think the Advocate's kind of subsumed it.
I think the Advocate is...
they kept the NOLA.com. But it's the Advocate. So I guess the Advocate. Your column was titled "George Washington: A Statue We Need,"
and George Washington Cable.
A statue we need, and that came out on July 5th. If you want to go back and take a look at it after this, so what prompted you to write the column, and what did you say in it for those of us who have not read it?
Sure. Well, following you know, the dispute over Confederate street names and monuments, I wanted to put forth two arguments. First, I felt that George Washington Cable should be remembered. He was the great late 19th century New Orleans novelist. He was a social critic. He was although he fought in the Civil War and was wounded, after the war, he became a very passionate defender of the rights of freedmen, as they were called, ex-slaves. And he published a line of articles, both nationally and locally, that put forth, if you will, the same kind of agenda that we're seeing debated today with Black Lives Matter. He wanted equity and justice for people of color. And he was basically driven out by the post-Reconstruction, social and political elite of New Orleans. They made life difficult for him. I don't think anybody burned a cross on his lawn, but he was ostracized, and he had a very good relationship with Century Magazine, sort of like the Atlantic or Harper's today, and eventually moved to New England. And my argument in the essay was that we should establish a statue of some kind to him for being a prophet, someone who was on the right side of history. The other point I made in the essay was that we shouldn't look at a one-size-fits-all formula for removing street names. And I gave the example of the Treme neighborhood, which is, of course, famous today as a seedbed of musicians. There was the HBO series Treme, which many people watched. But the founder of the neighborhood, Claude Treme, in fact, he was a Frenchman who moved to New Orleans and spent time in prison for killing a slave. He got out. He married the daughter of a wealthy planter, a slaveholding family, and he eventually, with her, sold off the tracts of land to free people of color as well as whites that became the neighborhood we know today as Treme. And I made the point that for most people who live in Treme, when you ask where they're from and they tell you, they're not thinking of the memory of Claude Treme. They're thinking of the neighborhood, the place name, and what it means to them as a place of culture and memory.
You know, as you're talking, there are a few different things that pass through my mind, but it just strikes me what a convoluted history we have, and we're kind of all wrapped up into this together, you know. George Washington Cable, I mean, what a great name. So celebrating the founder of our country and then fighting for, I assume he fought for the Confederacy, right, and was wounded.
Yes, that's correct. He was wounded, and he came home. He was very young when he went in. He was a teenager. And as he writes in one of his essays, what really moved him was trying to understand what he had fought for. I think like a lot of young white men then, he simply went off to war because that's what everybody was doing. And as he put it, what he learned upon reading at length was that 300,000 young men had lost their lives for what? The purpose of slave holding. And he did not believe in that.
That's interesting that you say that, because that is one of the crucial ideas in the Lost Cause, is that Southerners didn't fight to preserve slavery, that they instead fought for states' rights and to preserve autonomy.
That's true, and that's part of the myth of the Lost Cause. It is one of the more successful myths that I think we've seen, certainly in this country. You know, when I grew up, we didn't really have an adequate education on what the Civil War was. But I think what we're looking at right now is the struggle to fashion a new myth, and at least as it bears upon New Orleans, and by that I mean around the country with these Confederate statues coming down, the question is, well, what do you put in their place? What becomes the idea, the concept to take the place for a Confederate soldier or general or Jefferson Davis or someone like that? And I think what New Orleans has, and I'm not saying that other cities don't have this, but New Orleans has the distinction of being the city where jazz began. And any number of interpretations by monumental artists, those who create sculptures, can really go far in conveying a different idea of movement and the past. You know, I would love to see, for example, at Lee, what is still, I guess, called Lee Circle, even though Lee isn't there. No, but I think if they were...
So we're not going to call it the circle formerly known as Lee?
Well, it was originally Tivoli Circle.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
I don't know. Look, there's a commission being formed by the city council. And anytime I hear about a commission being formed, I kind of sit back and, you know, kind of nod my head. You know, if you want to kill a great idea, form a commission. But, you know, what I would love to see is some sort of competition to get great sculptors to provide ideas of what they would put in that space to convey the idea of what New Orleans is today. I mean, you could do a magnificent group sculpture of people in a dance hall. Now, whether you take down the long white column behind it or not, I don't know. Maybe you could leave it there as a symbol of the past. But it would be a far more arresting image. And then, you know, you could figure out what to name the circle after that. Jazz Circle wouldn't be so bad.
That's true. Yeah, our Armstrong Circle, put Louis up there.
Well, Armstrong
already has a park, so
he's got a park and he has the airport.
Good point. Yeah.
whereas, I might add, Moon Landrieu, who to me was one of the towering politicians of New Orleans history, the man who ushered us into the modern era, is not remembered with a statue. And I think maybe not there, but at some place in town, he certainly deserves to be remembered that way.
Totally. Listen, I wanted to ask you this question. So we said that George Washington Cable, you know, went, enlisted, fought in the war, was wounded, came back, and then tried to understand the Civil War and came to some conclusions that got him ostracized. Why was he different? What was it about his intellectual journey that led him to the spot where he said, you know, I've come to a radically different position, and I now support equity and justice for black people?
Do you mean why?
Yeah.
Why did he come to that conclusion?
Yeah, as when, when I'm assuming so many others didn't come to that conclusion, because
right.
there seemed to be, if anything. Now, one of the things we've often talked about is that the it's kind of an odd fit. New Orleans wasn't so much a Confederate hotbed. You know, it
Not
didn't really fight in the war. It got taken so easily when Farragut, I think, sailed up the river. And, you know, and it was not really seen as the great Confederate capital of Louisiana or of the South or anything else. And people there were largely indifferent. Not indifferent, but certainly not united behind the Confederate cause. So it seems odd for them to throw up all these monuments to P.T. Beauregard.
Well, yes, but what happened, you're absolutely correct in the way you have described New Orleans during the war. It was occupied in 1862, and Butler, Beast Butler, yeah, the Northern general who ran the city, by various accounts, did pretty well. For one thing, he all but eradicated yellow fever by insisting on upgraded sanitation of the city, which the rather slovenly performance of City Hall before the war had never bothered to do. But what happened after the war is that because the city was intact, it became a magnet for former Confederate soldiers from all across the South. So you had these people streaming into the city because, unlike you know, Atlanta and other parts of the South, it had not been bombed, it had not been burned, it was intact, and it ended up becoming a kind of mother lode, if you will, for the lost cause mythology, as you know, the various Confederate associations began to gain power. You know, Reconstruction was the war after the war, and the return of white power in the South came about because of lynching and depriving black people of the right to vote. It's one of the worst chapters in American history, and we're just now coming to terms with it, I think, as a nation, because of the unique circumstances we have today.
So people who are on the side of taking down the statues and a reappraisal would say that it's time to do that, that we've kind of let the lost cause and the ideology of the noble South, the plantation, the terras, the lost gone with the wind view of the whole thing, you know, completely overwhelm us, and that we need some balancing, so that they would say, you know, they would agree with your argument. I think they would say, you know, yes, that happened, but that wasn't a simple history. And I think the Tremé story really brings that out, you know, how tangled are the skeins that weave through the issues of how we remember a past with significant problems about it, you know, even seen by the most favorable kind of view.
Absolutely. And one of the points I really tried to drive home in that essay for The Advocate was that what we have really in New Orleans, and, you know, you might make this argument in Lafayette with the rich musical and culinary heritage of the area. When you have a kind of ethos that brings people together, and music does that, cuisine does that, It makes more sense to celebrate what unites us rather than what has divided us. And I do think New Orleans is well situated to do that. I hope we have political leadership that is wise enough to, you know, to do requests for proposals with world-class artists, sculptors who can come in and and provide the kind of blueprint and execution that will do that. The big problem now, of course, is money.
Yeah.
I mean, with the pandemic sapping governments across the country, I don't know when the money will be there to do that, but
pick up on one of your points. You know, if you just joined us, we are talking to author Jason Berry, who wrote a column for The Advocate recently and has written many books. We're talking about Confederate statues and what to do about them and how should the past be memorialized and remembered. You know, you said something that really struck me. You said, you know, we got to celebrate what unites us. And I was thinking, yeah, that's really true, because in a sense, the Confederate statues commemorate the uniting of white people in the South to establish a racial republic, you know, and looking back. I mean, that's really what it's about, the ability to, in my view, enslave black people and have black people as second-class citizens. So even the statues that are put up mostly in the, you know, 1910s and 20s, are about maintaining that racial order. But that's not us now. We've defined us differently, it seems to me. And if we want to put up statues that define all of us, we have to have statuary or memorials that are inclusive of everybody who's here and everybody who's played a big role. And you can't look at New Orleans and say anything about that city without saying, obviously, African Americans, French, other people played a huge role in that city.
That's true, and I am not original in saying this, but Albert Murray, the great jazz critic and cultural historian, made this point years ago. But jazz really is a metaphor of democracy. You have different instrumental voices coming together and finding resolution through the central line of melody. And that idea of different voices achieving a certain unity, a certain harmony, is really what democracy aspires to. Elections are not always perfect. We know that. But the idea of consent of the governed is embedded in, you know, the country that we share. And I think any kind of artistic representation of that, particularly at a time when we've become so deeply polarized. I mean, the country is toxic right now. And, you know, we're watching this psychodrama of the president who, whatever you may think of Donald Trump and his putative skills as a businessman, he seems to be at war with himself, trying to figure out, you know, how to revive his polling numbers. But I think the country is greater than that. And I think whether people are on the right or on the left, most of us really want the harmony and the unity that comes with a government that well represents the center, that brings us together from different sides. And statues, paintings, you know, murals are all able to do that if you provide enough of a working example by people who hold authority and power.
Let's talk about some of the figures. So you've said, mm-hmm. you know, if we are going to memorialize the past, let's think about some of who those figures might be. You mentioned we might have Moon Landrieu. Why would you put Landrieu in the pantheon of heroes of New Orleans?
Two reasons. He was the first mayor after the civil rights movement who opened the city, city hall and city government, to positions that African Americans could fill. And in that sense, he helped spur the development of a black middle class. And the other reason is that he and John McKiffin, then the governor, pushed very hard to build the Louisiana Superdome, which became an economic engine. So he was, you know, I think something of an urban visionary.
Then there's some other people that you've mentioned. I'm thinking in the jazz realm, was it Danny Barker and Ellis Marsalis, the scion of the Marsalis clan? I was thinking, you know, are you familiar with the Rodin statue, Burghers of Calais?
I absolutely am.
I was thinking that would be a great format for the Marsalis clan. You could get them all in there, you know.
Right. Went, well, it's interesting you mentioned that, Pearson, because the burgers of Calais, I spent at the tender age of 23, I spent 3 months in Paris, and I went over to the Rodin Museum probably a dozen times, and I just, that structure to me is such an ascendant work of art, and anything remotely approaching it in sort of stylistic terms, where you have a group of people rendered in bronze, can be used to great effect, whether they are in a dance hall, whether they are a band, whether they are figures in a parade, you know, all of which metaphorically convey a certain essence of New Orleans.
Particularly parades. I mean, if there's something that ought to be memorialized about New Orleans that is central to it and as has that there's no place else in the country like it, it has to be the idea of a parade. I mean, a second line parade, a Mardi Gras parade, all kinds of parades.
Or the jazz funeral, for that matter.
Yeah, jazz funeral.
Yeah, no, I really agree with you. And some of the other people I recommended, for example, were Lindy Boggs, who the congresswoman and later the ambassador to the Vatican. Mother Catherine Seals, the great faith healer in the Lower Ninth Ward. Sister Gertrude Morgan, who was the folk artist who was so much a part of Preservation Hall during the years in which it first arose. You know, you could make a list, and I think it would be wonderful if we had community involvement in something like this. I had 750 words to make my argument.
Right.
And there were a lot of other people I think I probably would have included if I'd had more length and more time to think about it. But it's interesting that Lafayette, from what I understand, is now considering a change with the statue of General Mouton. If the mayor has his way, the statue would be removed. You know, it leaves a space that could convey something greater about the social texture of Acadiana and Lafayette, depending on who the artist might be.
Yeah, Acadiana has come very, very late to a recognition of, and I'd say we're not there yet, anywhere close to
right.
a recognition of its multiracial past and the problems associated with that. I have a colleague, Rick Swanson, who is doing lectures around and publishing actually a book or two right now on the untold story of slavery in Acadiana. And as opposed to the garden variety story, which is, well, Cajuns were different, and since they were oppressed, they didn't oppress anybody else, so blacks and whites got along great here. Looking back at the actual history, you know, not the the rosy history, it turns out that's not really the case. And so he's uncovered, frankly, some ugly and painful truths. But those are the kind of investigations that need to happen so that people can really get right with the legacy and put the present into context.
Well, especially when you look at the history of Amédée Ardoin, the pioneering Zydeco artist who was beaten in a racial incident and basically died because of it. So there is an aura of tragedy to that. But at the same time, you know, I think we are looking for ways in which to capture the way society grows and how we gain by our knowledge of the past.
Well, let's focus on that a little bit. So one of the claims of the people who would preserve Confederate monuments or preserve monuments that we might now have been challenged would say that you're erasing history. How would you specifically address the idea that people said, you can't take down those monuments, that's history, and you're erasing it when you do so?
Well, the monuments are not history. They are symbols of the mentality of the people who put them up. And the lost cause, the belief that the South was tragic but ultimately triumphant, is a myth. And so by putting these Confederate statues across the South, what they were doing in essence was claiming victory. Well, we may have lost the Civil War, but we win the larger battle. We're going to write textbooks the way we want. We're going to teach kids a different version of the past, and here are the statues to prove it. So the history embedded in that statue is white supremacy. Now, do you want white supremacy to be the symbol of your town? I would argue that in this day and age, most towns do not.
Yeah, there's. It's interesting how victory is kind of preserved in for the forces of segregation, of slavery, of the lost cause in these monuments. There was interestingly something that made a lot of sense to me. I read a book called Race and Reunion by a very lovely book about how black and white, excuse me, how Northern and Southern soldiers came together to remember the great battles of the Civil War. And it talks about a 50-year reunion at Gettysburg that was quite important for this, for both sides to kind of come to grips with what had happened. So the Congress appropriated, believe it or not, almost a couple million dollars to transport veterans from both sides all over the country to the Gettysburg to meet on that battlefield and tell tales and have panels and just relive that moment, that incredibly important moment. You know what was odd about it? No black soldiers were brought.
Right.
No black,
right.
All white. So they could get together on, so the white soldiers on both sides were then in essence rewriting that history and saying, okay, this was about us. We were brothers who fought, but now we've reconciled, and it completely left out any sort of black participation one way or the other. And to me, that captured it, really, the idea of the lost cause and the kind of sealing of what that meant.
Right. You know, it is hard to imagine how an entire experience like the Civil War could be so tilted in the way it was remembered and taught for so long by erasing black people and the enslavement of so many Southerners from the full story. But that is changing now. It has been changing for quite a number of years. And I think it's healthy for a democracy to come to terms with its past. You know, I read a great book recently, Listening to the Germans, by an American scholar, Susan Nehmer, who is Jewish and has lived in Berlin for many years. And she draws a contrast between the way in which Germany, after the unification in 1989, slowly came to terms with the Nazi horror in their history and ended up building an enormous monument in Berlin to that. And then she travels through the South and makes the case that we have not gotten to that point in the South, even though the Civil War took place many years before, you know, the Second World War. So I think we're on a journey with this as a region and as a country. And, you know, I tend to take an optimistic view of the human experiment.
Well, let's hope we get to the end of that journey. We have been talking today with author Jason Berry, author of his most recent book, City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. Thanks for joining the show today, Jason.
Great pleasure, Pearson. Thank you.
Thank you.